Let me just give you some way of background about what sort of sparked in part the convergence debate. The convergence debate, I think, got a lot of momentum from a series of really exciting articles written by, the shorthand is the Gang of Four, which is Raphael Laporta, Lorenzo de Lucinis, Andre Schleifer, and Robert Vishney. Four economists, so both of those are centered at Harvard. One is at the University of Chicago. I think we all expect that someday, very soon, that Andre Schleifer will be among those who will be earning a Nobel laureate in due course. The work that he did was path-breaking. I guess what I would like to say is path-breaking but flawed. But not to take anything away, they came up with an intriguing vision about whether you could create an index that would reflect the quality of a legal regime, particularly a corporate law regime, around the world. And then, if you had a reliable index that would be created, compare that against metrics about how those countries were performing in terms of financial health and well-being. And we can have lots of indices about countries that are doing well by measuring things such as the frequency of initial public offerings of securities, because economies that grow, the companies need capital, and they'll engage in public offerings. So the uptick in public offerings is a good measurement of financial health of a country. Economists have long measured for within individual economies and across economies, a strength of firms and cultures by a so-called Tobin Square, which is a multi-factor dimension, which really looks at how much cash is generated by enterprises or an enterprise or enterprises within a country. High Tobin Squares, high IPOs translate to healthy economies. So the image would be that if you had an index, then you could take that up of law, an equality of law, then you see how that index lines up. And for those of us that are corporate scholars, which I'm schizophrenic, I'm half a corporate scholar and half a security law scholar, but those of us that are corporate scholars and those of us that are lawyers found out, took great solace in the study, because found out that the Gang of Four documented that strong legal rules translated to well-performing economies. Bottom line of that is law matters and matters a lot. Good law, good economies. That's a winning formula when you spend time before national legislatures like I do, going around trying to tell them, get your law improved, protect your investors, protect your shareholders, is a way of stimulating and strengthening your economy. Now, at that point, it's in my interest to step down and let everything just go by the boards and say, law matters, and that makes my life a lot easier. And it actually makes me feel good about being a law professor, because it means I'm doing something worthwhile. Well, let me tell you a little bit about my paper. My paper has really two foci to it. One is to criticize the index that was performed by the Gang of Four and saying, well, we're among friends here, aren't we? Rubbish. And I think that when you look at the 9 indicia that were used to form the index, that you have to realize that something else must be going on, because these 9 factors that the Gang of Four use to formulate their index are not exactly winning factors by somebody who spends a lifetime on corporate law believing they have anything to do with shareholder protection. So that's one level. Now, not to leave you without hope then, because we all sell hope, I'd like to point to the fact that I think that what's probably a more meaningful area to look at in terms of explaining these high Tobin Squares and high IPOs and growing and robust economies is not just the abundance of natural resources, But I think that it would also be the fact, strong security force. And that I think that probably a more fruitful area to look at for linkages between high Tobin squares and IPOs would be security laws, not corporate law, for reasons I'll have hopefully have time to say going to. And so we look at that. And I also make another argument that it goes back to what Dan was saying. A theme in many parts of today's meeting is the convergence debate. And that, my point in the second part of the paper is that you're more likely to find convergence in a meaningful way in areas that are be labeled as securities law than you would in an area that would be in a bucket called corporate law. And I have some reasons for that. Let me just say a moment about why the convergence debate is important. I'll begin by the fact of saying just the opposite. Whether there's convergence or not convergence is probably not very relevant. Like many things that professors do, the ultimate game is probably not all that relevant. Let me give you some examples. The debate in the mid-1980s in corporate law was whether the corporation is nothing more than a nexus of contracts, a bundle of contracts, and to be understood about this. The debate then moved to the strong economy that Japan was having and the German economy was having. And so the debate in the early 1990s was a question about, doesn't the American model want to move to a relational investor model so that banks would assume a more important role and large holders would have a more important role to improve the performance of the American economy? Something happened in Japan in the early 1990s that made that debate go away. The economy went into the tank. Now, what's the debate or discussion today? In 2006 and 2007, in many parts of the world, not just America, the debate about hedge funds and private equity funds and these large investors and what impact they're having, both in trading markets and securities regulation issues, but also governance issues. Now, at the end of the day, the nexus of contracts, the relational investor, wasn't really a question about what the ultimate question was, any more than the convergence debate. What's important here is the lessons you learn in the process of engaging in the debate. You know, when we talked about whether a contract corporation was a bundle of contracts, or the role of relational investment, we gain better insight to the multiple social and economic forces that impact business enterprises. And as a result, enlightenment emerges, and as a result of that enlightenment, legal rules get better, and scholarship gets better. So it's not a question about who wins the debate, it's a question about let's participate in the discussion. So to that point, let's talk a little bit about convergence of factors. Daniel Ford listed 9 factors that went into their index. And then if you had a high index figure, then you had a strong body of law. And then they're able to find a correlation between that strong body of law measured by their index, so they see that, and the economic indicia of economic performance and robustness of your economy. Great picture. It's the type of things that Nobel Prizes were awarded for, okay? And so let's just look at, and also something else relates to this whole thing, is in a series of papers they find that in countries with low indexes and therefore low performance, what do you find? You find that there's high concentrations of ownership of stocks. So you find in countries with miserable ratings, Italy, for example, South American countries, you find that you generally in public companies have a substantial investor in those countries. In countries with high ratings, the United Kingdom, the United States, their markets are characterized by dispersed ownership where you don't find a controlling stockholder. So the cause and effect is weak laws drive people to having controlling stockholders or vice versa. So those are parts of the thing. Let's talk about their index. First thing that piqued my interest in their paper was the idea that what they decided not to measure, immediately my antennae went up. They identified three, the Gang of Four says, three areas of law that did not put in their index. One, merger and takeover rules. I found that interesting because I teach a corporate law class that's almost entirely about mergers and takeovers. I'm trying to wonder, what is the other, what else do you talk about? Okay. I knew I was going to learn more about corporate law by reading their paper. They didn't talk about disclosure rules. More than half my life is about disclosure rules. Suddenly I was feeling trivialized, okay? Perhaps even angry, okay? And then they leave out a whole body of law, which I think can be characterized as what's called soft law. It's not soft in rigor, but they leave out the whole law on listing requirements for stock exchanges, which in the United States, that's where our governance rules appear. You know, you hear a lot of misinformation about what Sarbanes-Oxley, a four-letter word in America, does. Well, Sarbanes-Oxley doesn't lay a hand on governance. Those are listing requirements by the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ. Same thing with requirements for nominating committees. Same thing for what sort of items have to be submitted to shareholders for vote, must be submitted to shareholders for vote. Those are listing requirements. All of that's off the table in the Gang of Four. So now let me just roll along here, and I'll stay within my time limit, making Dan feel better about looking at his watch. Oh, and something else they don't pay any attention to. Competition law. You ever think about the connection there? Where you have competition for your product market, the products that you make, that has a disciplining effect on managers. Managers are much more sensitive to performance if you have open markets for your products that you deal with. And so they don't even measure that in the Gang of Four. A lot of problems with the Gang of Four, okay? But they're not economists, they're not rigorous lawyers, but we are. But let's talk about some of these things. One part of their index, okay? Oh, let me just put something up there. What I'm suggesting here is that I agree with the metrics about Tobin Squares and IPO. Where I disagree is, and I don't disagree with their findings that America and the UK have good laws protecting their investment. Okay, that's my priors, and I'll agree with that. Okay, what I'm saying is that there must be something else that explains, okay, how they put people in different buckets, not the nine factors that they look at. That there must be something else that these nine factors are a surrogate for, where you sign strong corporate law protections must be in that same bucket other laws, like merger and acquisition laws that make sense, securities laws that make sense, listing requirements that move together. But they just looked at the wrong place and stumbled on to the right answer, okay, is what I would be saying. Let me give you an example. One thing that they point out as a law metric is proxy voting by mail. A country that allowed proxy voting by mail was given a high score. Well, I would just point out that I think that's only part of the story. Okay, so you let people vote by mail. My question would be, how much information do they have when they make that vote? Disclosure. You know, how do we know that is a viable method? They point to the existence of cumulative voting. If a country permits cumulative voting, that gets a high score. And they put America in that category of cumulative voting. I found that astounding. There's only two of our 51 jurisdictions in America that make cumulative voting mandatory. Most public companies don't have cumulative voting. And they cite to Delaware as requiring cumulative voting. And in fact, Delaware does not require it. And what about your ability to solicit others for their process? So just the ability to call a special meeting doesn't answer the question. In America, we're very hostile to shareholder action. Unlike your country, shareholders in America shareholders in America cannot introduce a resolution to change the company's articles of incorporation. Therefore, they do not have the strategic ability to be able to change the direction of the business or change the governance structure. That can only occur upon first approval by the board of directors. So calling a special meeting, all you get is a free box lunch if you're lucky, but maybe nothing else of any consequence is going to happen there. Ah, mandatory dividends. High score for those countries that got mandatory dividends. In six countries, they found that there was a requirement of mandatory dividends. Five of those countries were in Latin America who got the lowest scores. Okay? None of those were in countries that got high scores. Okay? So I'm not sure what to make of that factor. I hope you join with me at this point and realize, one, I only have six more minutes. Two, that I think that the index at the end of the day just doesn't work. Okay? Now, I'm not just picking on one article. They've written a whole bunch of articles. And then the other thing I'll say is the Gang of Four's index is used by many more people, okay, out there talking about the convergence debate and why law matters. At the end of the day, bravo, law matters, corporate law. Let's talk about corporate law. Let's talk about your changes here in Japan. Oh, sure, you did certain things to increase with your reforms over the last 15 years, did certain things to increase the rights that's protecting the shareholders. You expanded the rights and prerogatives of the supervising auditor. You've introduced the limited scale derivative suits. You know, several issues. But if you look at most of those changes, we're doing exactly what we do in the United States with our reforms of corporate law. And that is what? Making it easier for managers to do the deal. Facilitating. Corporate law, whether we like it or not, is largely facilitating, largely enabling. And whether you look at the law of the United States, the law of Japan, the changes introduced in Europe, wherever you look, what is the trend you see over the last 70 years? That is increasingly more flexible corporate laws, fewer and fewer mechanical requirements that existed previously for the benefit and protection of shareholders. So corporate law is largely facilitated. And so if you're going to expect any great protection for widows, widowers, and orphans, okay, the lowly stockholders, I don't think you're going to find it in the legislative bodies cranking out corporate law because you're swimming against the current. So, on this point, let me just make some suggestions. My suggestion would be, where is this groundswell going to come from for making laws more protective? I don't see it in the interest of entrenched interest in an economy to favor strong capital laws. Spare me your comments about the cost of capital. Managers are so well insulated from the high cost of capital or raising cost of capital, and it's at the margins anyway, that they're not going to become great champions of strengthening their corporate laws. Okay? So where are we going to find these changes from? My neighbor makes several references here to the fact that I believe that if there's going to be convergence, but that convergence is more likely to occur around what I would say would be securities law, not corporate law. Now, Professor Ioka made a very good observation on my paper, what is corporate law and what is securities law? Securities law is based upon matters related to financial reporting. So anything related to the process of disclosure, and including making that those disclosures more trustworthy, which would be like the audit committee and the role of outside auditors and independence of auditors would all be securities law regime. The reason in part that you will find that there'll be convergence in that area is that money, just like products, flow across borders. Corporate law is largely territorial and reflects some of the indigeneity of production processes which are path dependent, in part because of resources and culture that exist in those economies. It's going to be very hard to change that, and we don't have to change it. But because money flows across borders and decisions are made across borders, there's a huge process of network externalities there, which are going to force commonality. We see this going on as we talk. More and more countries around the world have evolved to semi-annual reporting. Now they're going to have quarterly reporting, uniformity of statements going on across things. You find organizations that now meet every 6 months, kind of IOSCO and other groups, who come together and talk about how we're going to have commonality in disclosure regimes. When you put these factors together, okay, you see that there is a culture that exists outside your borders, outside my borders, that are all talking about commonality. And the commonality is transactions. You don't just raise money these days in Wall Street. You don't just raise money these days in London. You have a tranche of money in different locations that you're raising. And so therefore, the bankers in New York and the bankers in London and the bankers in Tokyo, you know, all have a heavy orientation toward all having the same set of documents and the same sort of disclosures going on for their institutions that are buying this money. When you put the concluding part of my paper together, you find that not only are there forces there for convergence in the disclosure area, but not only are those forces existent, they're at play as we go forward. Now I've run out of time. Thank you very much.